So in your article, almost 10 years ago now, for India Outlook, you talk about your despair and your desperation with regards to the, quote, living death of Kashmir, and how you've witnessed that. And I guess I wanted to ask you, like, what role your films play in this regard. You identify first and foremost as a filmmaker, and are the films an attempt to just kind of document that despair and that desperation? How do you define your practice?
Primarily, I see myself as a storyteller. Storyteller with my documentaries, because documentary filmmaking is just one aspect of my filmmaking. My aim and ambition is really and truly centered on fiction filmmaking, which I've not been able to do because of the different kinds of ideas which work in market and which don't. With documentaries, I want to tell stories, and I also want to chronicle what's been happening with me, with things around me. My documentaries are my stories. They are about where I come from, who I am, what I have become, and what I could have become. Do I see my films affecting people? I really have a very pessimistic view about the practice of art. Maybe not many people will agree with me there. Nothing changes really. You know, it takes a lot of time for new ideas to seep in, for them to be accepted. While they are being accepted, they also become corrupted in a way. So it's really difficult for me to hope that even if I'm making my films with all my heart and passion, that they will really affect people or change their point of view about something. The fact is, maybe I'm still the same guy who was there 10 years back. Has my point of view about world changed? I don't think much. Maybe it's become modified, maybe it's become concretized in some way. But has it changed in a way which is different from what I was 10 years back? I'm not sure. I hope that answers this particular.
But in a way, the films are an attempt to account for that bitterness, that anger, and that lack of, let's say, belief in a prompt resolution.
Yes, there is a bit of hope there, because even if you're talking bitterly or in anger or in frustration, you are hoping that, because when you make something, it is for public view, it is in the public domain, that somewhere it will affect a change. They'll see what people are going through, and maybe through that affect some change in their thinking. I saw Kashmir dying 10 years back. Today I see it going madder. You know, it's not recovering. There's something that is, I won't say irreparably, but something that is truly damaged in every Kashmiri. And I found a word for it, which is a common word, which is called schizophrenic. In a way, every Kashmiri has become a schizophrenic today. They are divided between the loyalties to the religion, to their country, which they don't know where it is, whether it is Kashmir or it's India or it's Pakistan, to many things, you know, and the kind of violence Kashmir has seen in the last 20 years, it's bound to have a deep impact on people.
And so that's reflected in, for instance, the very title of this most recent storytelling work, A Poor Tea, A Poor, which is like a no war, no peace. It's these kind of these border villages that you're exploring and that you're trying to pick, to represent, that are somehow in this kind of no man's land, right? Somehow situated, somehow paradoxically, between India and Pakistan. They're kind of schizophrenic in that sense. Is that what you were trying to get at in focusing on those specific communities and villages?
Okay. Let me talk a bit about the film. This film starts at the border and trying to define the notion of border. But this film, as we go along with it, it is about Kashmir. Mm-hmm. Because if there's a border, there's also a war zone, there's also a borderland where the violence is actually happening. So Kashmir is caught between the border and the mainland. You know, it is a war zone. So this is what the film is about. And the title, which means, you know, it's very colloquial Kashmiri. Apoor to Yapoor means Kashmir is a valley. So the borders of Kashmir are defined naturally by the hills, tall mountains surrounding it. So for a Kashmiri, everything that's outside the valley is Apoor. So these are natural and boundaries, but here it's a man-made boundary. It's still Pakistan is Apoor, so is India Apoor, and Yapoor means this side. There has been a conflict, you can say, for 60 years now, because that's when the problem started. Many peace initiatives, many highs and lows, but there's no end to the conflict. So it is a typical ironical situation where you can't even say, okay, now there is peace, where you can't even say, oh, this is war. You know, it's always fluctuating between these two extremes, and it's created a different sort of unrest. And the third part of the title, which is called Yitcho Talukpet, means everything is topsy-turvy here. You know, you can turn every logic, every argument around to express your own point of view. If somebody says, I support India, he'll quote history. But the same history will be turned around by an opponent who wants to, you know, go for independence of Kashmir, or who wants Kashmir to become Pakistan. So nothing is stable. So this is what the title explains.
I was wondering if we could go back to this article in India Outlook. It's entitled Going Home, but then some ways in, as you reflect on a moment 12 years prior to the writing of it, about this moment when the militants of Jammu and the Kashmir Liberation Front and the Hizbullah Mujahideen dealt your sense of identity as an Indian a humiliating blow, you explain how it's very hard to go home. And I was wondering if you could talk about this notion as a Kashmiri exile. Can you talk about both home and the process of going home, and are your films in a way caught up and emblematic of that question of what it means to go home?
See, there are two things about going home. I grew up in Kashmir, so I think you're made up of what of your initial growing up years. Those things never change. When I wanted to make films, I was not interested in making Bollywood films or mainstream Hindi films, because I always thought they were, in a way, very colonial influence on other cultures. You know, maybe Kashmir is in that way very different from the mainstream India. As a filmmaker, I always wanted to go back to Kashmir and make my films in Kashmiri language, because you don't make films in Kashmiri language. There are no resources and maybe no interest. But I couldn't do that. The moment I finished my filmmaking training, the war started. And so for 10 years, I was left with, you know, thinking, what can I do now? I can't make Bollywood. So it was as a filmmaker, it was a very miserable existence, because you couldn't really talk about what you want to do. So going home, in a way, is going back to a place where you couldn't trust people, because there is a effect of violence on your own community. Generally, because even Kashmiris were not spared, even people who supported Pakistan, or, you know, there was killing on both sides. You didn't know who is killing who is bombing who. So general feeling of scare, and the fact that Hindus in Kashmir were targeted, and I belong to that community. And also at the same time, knowing that I'm not really religious, I don't identify with my community as such, but it's only when you go to an embattled zone, then you realize, oh, you're vulnerable because you're perceived as this. So going home was traumatic in that way, but it also was a positive thing, because after that I really knew that, okay, maybe if it's about conflict, it's about pain and sorrow, my films are going to be about conflict and pain and sorrow, but it's going to be about Kashmir. After that, I never made a film without Kashmir being in context. This is my third film since. All my films have been about Kashmir. I'm thinking of doing a fiction film. I can't shoot that in Kashmir because I don't want to shoot with army protection and police protection. I'm going to shoot that in mainland India, but it is about Kashmir and it's about Kashmiri people.
But I think you were also getting at that it's difficult to go home, to go back home, not just on account of the violence, the conflict, the inability to trust and find safety or a respite from fear, but is it also something that has to do with memory? In the very beginning, for instance, of this most recent work, this older woman is asked, you know, to talk about old times, and she explains that she doesn't remember anything. Does it have to do with memory? It's difficult to go back there, to go back home to Kashmir, because what's being erased is memory.
See, you are not erasing memory. Problem is, you don't want to recollect those memories because you really don't want to deal with pain if your memories... There have been good memories also, but I think they have become overshadowed by the events that happen later. Memories are there. There are bad memories, but... Maybe I feel a bit positive about that. I think you can overcome. You have to forget. You have to make yourself forget. And maybe not talking about them is a way to forget. If you have to reconcile, if you have to come back home, there's no other place. You know, maybe you travel all over the world, but you're connected there. You know, it's strange for me. When I was growing up in Kashmir, I hated that place. Because there were no avenues for me, you know, to be an artist or a filmmaker or a theater person in a very conservative society was a strange thing to do. So you were already isolated there. So it was a difficult period growing up there. But once you're out, then there's a strange attraction about the place. You know, it's difficult to make out what makes you go back home. It's not pleasant memories, it's not painful memories, but it's just the fact that it's part of you.
But can you talk more about the relationship between storytelling and forgetting? Because when I look at your films and when I read your writings, it's very much about recovering and holding on to historical events, be those positive or traumatic. But then indeed you also always emphasize this possibility of reconciliation or forgiveness. So how do you negotiate a storytelling which is about recovering and holding on to the past and the importance of forgetting, as you just said?
See, I do think reconciliation has to happen. I do think that it takes time for that to happen. You know, some things really need to be forgotten. But I also know that this is 20 years is nothing in terms of time. You know,
it's not enough.
It's not enough because Indians still retain the memories. Maybe it didn't happen to them, but memories of partition violence that happened 60 years ago to their forefathers. But forgetting and recollecting is part of, you know, it's where the conflict in your mind comes from, and a filmmaker or a storyteller always thrives on these kinds of conflicts. If Kashmir was a very ordinary place, if there was no conflict there, and if you were to make films in Kashmir, you would have to invent a conflict. You know, you can't. You know, it's very contradictory. But the fact is, this is how you're looking at Kashmir. This is how you see life around you. And you try to deal with it in the best way you can. You want reconciliation, but at the same time, at the back of your head, you also don't want to forgive. You also don't want to forget. You know, it's a constant game that is going on in your mind. It also depends on how people react to you. If they are forgiving, then okay, you are also forgiving. If they are confrontationist, then, you know, so I think it needs a lot of maturity and time, I think, is a vital factor.
I'm interested, I mean, to stay on this theme of contradiction or tension, I'm interested in how you're at the same time arguing that that it's not clear that there will be a resolution in 50, even 100 years, right? On the one hand, there's this suspicious or skeptical regard that you have for conventional stratagems and discourses of conflict or resolution, right? There's a skepticism of that. And at the same time, there's this aspiration for some reconciliation in a way. I'm interested in that contradiction, that conviction that even 100 years from now, as you write in that piece, we will be no closer to resolution. And yet at the same time, that is also this aspiration that you live with.
It is a contradiction, but I mean, why does a man hope? Uh-huh. You know, you hope against hope. You know that the situation as it is now. I think this too. This is with any human situation. Uh-huh. You can't go back to the old in the same way it was. Mm-hmm. You know, something has changed, and you have to include that change in negotiating your future. Same thing has to be with Kashmir. I don't know what kind of a resolution there can be, but I think any resolution that saves people from madness will be a better resolution. At the same time, I understand that any resolution is a potential for
further violence,
further conflict. You know, it doesn't end. Maybe the tone and the tenor of the conflict is going to change.
And so in a certain sense, there's an ethic to accept that contradiction rather than try to deny it or overcome it. You know?
I think I would rather accept. I have been wavering. You know, this is a difficult thing people find about me. I'm not very, and I don't want to state it as a very clear statement that this is it and there is no other way. You know, I don't have one opinion. Mm-hmm. I want to just be like that. Find a way within, because it's walking a thin line. So I think my films walk that thin line.
And I'm interested also in the way that for you, if I understand correctly, there are many disputes between, for instance, India and Pakistan, between India and Kashmir, but somehow. There are many tensions, there are many conflicts, but in a way, Kashmir for you is emblematic of all of them, or at the heart of them, would you say that? Is central to these various tensions, or the genesis of these disputes? Or?
See, Kashmir is really on the front line of the tension between India and Pakistan. There are many tensions between India and Pakistan, which are deep-rooted, you know, which go back to 1,000 years in history, prior to coming of Islam to India, and whatever tensions arose because of that. But Kashmir happens to be on the front line. It's like some people say, like when two neighbors grate against each other, they crush. You know, Kashmir has been described as that, between the Battle of the Giants. It's Kashmir. There is some truth to that. But Kashmir in itself is a problem. You know, there's an inherent problem within Kashmir also. So that is adding to it. You know, it doesn't subtract from the greater India-Pakistan conflict. It adds to it. Kashmir suffers from India-Pakistan conflict. But Kashmir also has a very important part to play as being part of that conflict. I'm not sure if I'm making sense here.
And I know that you explained previously that in a way you make these films, you make these, you document, you engage in the storytelling for yourself in part, and to negotiate the questions that you yourself have. But I also hear from you this concern that secular institutions in India have not traditionally spoken up for the traumas that have taken place in your community in Kashmir, and also elsewhere in India now. So I guess the question I have is like, who are these films addressed to? They're addressed to yourself, clearly. Is it addressed to these secular institutions in India that you feel have not risen to the occasion, that have not spoken up sufficiently?
Actually, that is what it is addressed to, and I think I failed there because it's not really hadn't. You know, I think the filmmaking tradition in India, especially the documentary tradition, is you make films which preach to the converted. My films don't preach to the converted. It wants to change some perceptions. It wants to affect some perceptions. But I don't see those perceptions affected because I think it's my phone. Is it? I'll take it later. So, yeah, it breaks my... addressed to people who can understand, who are not rigid, who talk of themselves as being liberal and less conservative about issues. But I don't think I made an impact there.
And I'm interested in the nature of your practice, which is storytelling, as you said. It's documentary in some sense. Documentary filmmaking tradition is something that it seems you identify with. But would you say it's about the testimonial, or it's not that at all? To what degree are you trying to represent, so to speak, the traumas and the conflicts of Kashmir? To what degree is that just not your project? In other words, woven throughout your article for India Outlook is this reflection, recovery of the traumas of the past. Mm. But then your films, are your films that? They don't seem to be...
No, they aren't. It's the kind of person I am. I generally feel alienated from the general populace, or whether it is my own small community, which is in exile. I don't talk to them because I don't... I think they have very different views on that. I don't identify with the majority. I am on the borderline trying to strike up a conversation on my own terms through my own understanding. But I don't want to claim to represent any point of view. Though you can say it does, end up representing some general point of view. That is unavoidable.
And then in this article from almost 10 years ago, you conclude, or you end wanting to ask the people in Kashmir, your people in Kashmir, about why they haven't given up the option of violence. Would that be the same question you'd ask them today?
No, there has been a change. I think 9/11 was a momentous event, not only for America. It changed lots of things, even in India-Pakistan relationship and in Kashmir. Today, the kind of violence you have been seeing in the last 20 years is not there. There are no guns, there are no bomb blasts, there are no terrorist or militant activities. People have been, whether you call it the Indian army has prevailed or whether it's been given up voluntarily, these are debatable things. Today there are no guns, but there is a lot of violence in the mind, you can evidence at in my film and at the end of the film, that once you are up against a wall, you will throw stones. You know, stone pelting is a very common phenomenon. You know, you pick up stones and throw it at police or whatever. That is violence. But they can't pick up guns because they've lost that option. You know, they think it's done much more damage to them rather than getting sick of violence. I think being sick of violence is also there, but it's not the only reason. It's the reason also is that it's not served our purpose. It's not won us the war. But violence is very much there. It's pent up, and I think in that way much more dangerous.
You mean the violence has been internalized?
Internalized. Yeah. You know, it's, as I said, this, it's become pathological in Kashmir. Violence is in the way you argue your point of view. Violence is in the way you feel yourself victimized and the way you react to things. In a very irrational way, you know, it's become much more potent, and it could have there's a lot of mental sickness cases in Kashmir, you know, which was not there 20 years back. So violence has done a lot of damage. Let's not only say violence can be equated to giving a gun or doing bomb blast. It's become part of your psyche. My film, incidentally, which I'm going to do in fiction, is about two Kashmiri guys who become serial killers because violence is so internalized in them. You know, they find this killing people as a relief, as a justification for their being. You know.
So what role, I mean, we've talked about storytelling, but like, so what role does poetry and literature play in your practice? There seems something profoundly lyrical about it. There doesn't seem to be like a heavy narrative voice, although you've clearly edited it and constructed it. I don't know, what's the role of language in your work? How do you go about, at the same moment, translating and subtitling this work? How do you... I mean, you know, I'm watching this work in Philadelphia. Like, how do you negotiate questions of cultural difference, questions of translation in your practice? Because you're not, you know, this isn't work that's being shown in Kashmir as much as it's being shown.
Yeah, that's going to be. I don't know. See, in a way, I feel limited because of my where I come from. The kind of education I've had and the kind of life I've had is very non-Kashmiri. It's not confined. So I don't even know Kashmiri that well. I don't even know how to write my language or speak it in the same way as I speak English or Hindi. So at the same time, I also feel constrained about using my language to transcend frontiers of other cultures. Because there are too many details, too many aspects, which are inevitably lost in translation.
Are they untranslatable, or are they just resist translation?
I think it's more to do with resisting translation. You know, I there's this thing about why should I have to translate? You know, why? I think this is a recent thing with me. Why doesn't a French guy feel so self-conscious about using French words in his normal day-to-day conversation? Why not Kashmiri? So I think one word, Kashmir, I have used the way Kashmiris speak of themselves as Kashir. So I'm trying to do that, but somewhere I think one has again to strike a balance.
It's a negotiation.
To reach out to the world as well as to retain yourself.
What is the legacy of nationalism for you? What does it mean?
Nationalism, I don't actually see it as a burden. You know why? I think it is a reaction to how people have responded to Kashmir issue. While Kashmiris are burdened by this idea of nationalism, but people from outside Kashmir who support this Azadi movement or going with Pakistan have de-burdened themselves of the same idea or same notions of nationalism. they ideally don't believe in being, you know, attached to a country. So there's a contradiction there. And my response to it is, I don't want to be burdened by this nationalism idea. I don't want to say I'm not an Indian. Problem is, I'm also a Kashmiri. How is India as a country any different from any other country? It's a place where I was born. It's a place where I grew up. And it's good or bad as any other country, so one has to negotiate with that. You know, it's like a country is also like the society you're living in, or the family, or the home you're living in. You can always try your best to improve, to make conditions better. But how can you give up? How can you just say, I don't belong here? Then where do you belong? You know, it's, you have to be anchored somewhere in that bigger sense. But that doesn't mean you're mad about your nationalism or your, you know, I would say it's, again, striking a balance.
If we were to go back to this discussion of hope that we had before, engaged before, this notion that generations have now passed and passed by in Kashmir without hope, without resolution. I was wondering how you communicate that in your films. How do you communicate that loss of hope or that lack of resolution? Like how do you, from a strategic point of view, as a tactic, as an editor, as a filmmaker, how do you communicate something like that?
I think it is how do you make films? There's something in your films which you've not consciously tried to say, which you've not consciously tried to project, but it gets said. I believe films are not only communicating ideas. A film has to work as an emotion, maybe a contradictory emotion, but I think that sense of hopelessness is an emotion for me, and my films try to communicate that sense of, it's common to all my films about Kashmir. Mm-hmm. I really don't see much hope, except if people change. Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that I, if I understand correctly, you've thought about this issue as well is, you know, going back 9 or 10 years to that article, you spoke about how at that moment Pakistan was espousing, the Prime Minister was espousing, three fundamentally different positions on the question of accession. And you seem to be very suspicious of this kind of double standard or of this political approach that would espouse somewhat contradictory perspectives simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Seems you were arguing that you can't say multiple contrary things at the same time. It seemed at that moment that for you politics was problematic if it entailed kind of offering, you know, different perspectives.
See, I think my views have changed a bit. Contradiction is part of us. Let's not say that, oh, I'm not a hypocrite. Uh-huh. We are all hypocrites, and if we accept that, mm-hmm. We are all contradicting ourselves. Let's accept that and try to say, you know, what can be less contradictory or less hypocritical. Every country, you know, I see a nation as a live organism. It represents greater than the sum total of its people. If people or an individual is contradictory or hypocritical, or a nation will also be. A nation represents the psyche of its people. So even India has been hypocritical with regard to Kashmir, with regard to many things. But these are the things, tools by which we survive and negotiate our security.
So can you go back and help me understand, in that moment, historically, what were these three arguments that were being suggested by the Pakistani government? And at that time, and then at the same moment, so you were, at that moment, you were uncomfortable with this kind of contradiction that these three positions were espoused. Mm-hmm. It was almost as if none of them were sincere, right? Whereas today you find that to be emblematic of politics, of all of our psyche.
Human nature, greed, you know, greed about land. What actually was happening in at the time of independence was India was roughly 500 princely states which were not directly under the British, and some parts of India were directly under the British. So those parts were not in a problem. The princely states had to choose whether they would go with Pakistan or with India. Most of the princely states could decide either way. Now, there were three states which couldn't decide or were deciding in a way which was not seen favorably by the other. Like, there was a state called Junagadh in Gujarat. There was a state called Hyderabad. Mm-hmm. And there's a state called Jammu and Kashmir. Jammu and Kashmir was Muslim majority, and Pakistan thought, oh, it's a cakewalk. It belongs to us. So there's no fight about it. It will come back to us eventually. Junagadh was Muslim king with Hindu population. But the Muslim king decided to go to Muslim state, Pakistan. So that contradicted people's aspirations and people's will versus the prince, the king's desire. Hyderabad state wanted to be independent. It was a Muslim king, but Hindu subjects. Again, you know, notionally, by the rules of two-nation theory or partition, it should have belonged to India. Kashmir was reverse. Muslim population majority and Hindu. But he couldn't decide. He wanted to be independent. So India could take Junagadh and Hyderabad, you know, through army action or police action. But on the same principles, it should have let Kashmir go to Pakistan. It didn't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it used the other two examples of Pakistan's, you know, to take back, to keep Kashmir. So I think both sides were contradictory. It's just that one side won the argument, prevailed in a way. Am I clear on this? I think there's...
But it's not simple. I mean, maybe perhaps this is a very naive question, but to you, independence wouldn't resolve this.
I think independence... my film says it very clearly. The synopsis reads, the film maps the journey, the emotional and psychological journey of Kashmir, from the idea of, you know, India, that Kashmir feel that they want to be independent, or it's very clear, I'm not denying that. But as a Kashmiri and as an Indian, I think it would lead to greater conflict within Kashmir as well as within the subcontinent, between India and Pakistan. It wouldn't really resolve the issues we're seeking to resolve.
And that's the contradiction. That's one of the contradictions.
People's will, if you go by that, Kashmir should be independent.
You identify with that.
Yeah, I do. But again, I see people's will as same thing as, you know, in a negative way, if you compare it to Germany of World War II era, or Gujarat in India of this time, where they all want a Hindu state and keep the minorities. You know, it's a majority, it's people's will, you can say. But it's not obviously a correct thing to do. It's like Germans at that point of time were all in favor of Hitler and what he was doing. But were they right? So I see, I'm still trying to make up my mind on this, but I think it's not going to, you know, it's going to complicate matters even more.
So I suppose that my final question has to do with dialogue, and Do you believe in the dialogic? Do you believe in the possibility of like a reconciliation through a dialogic practice?
Yeah, I do. But I'm also not very sure whether it works or it doesn't work. I think human nature is basically against dialogue.
You mean that, I mean, to push you on this, you mean that you believe in that as a practice, but the outcome is not assured?
The outcome is, you can say it worked because of dialogue, it worked because of reconciliation, but there are very human factors of how empowered you feel, how much you think you can lose or gain. I believe in selfishness, not as a principle, but I think we are essentially selfish. We look out for our own interests, whether as human beings or as nations or whatever. We want our own comfort. So if you can negotiate anything within those parameters, then dialogue works.
And
if you can't negotiate, then dialogue doesn't work. If you can give the other person a feeling that his or her interests are also being taken care of while you're keeping your interests in mind, you know, lose some, win some, zero sum games, these things really work. And if dialogue can be done with this realization, I think dialogue is a positive thing to do.
Is that what your film sets out, your work in film sets out to do, or that's not really your project?
I don't talk about dialogue. I think when I was talking about reconciliation, I must have been very heartbroken at that point of time. Reconciliation means what? Can you go back to the same position you were in? You can't. Theoretically and practically, you can't. So, dialogue, where does it begin? Starting from now, today, can you forget the past? Can you forgive? If you can do that, well, dialogue is a positive thing. But then these things remain in your mind. You know, generations carry it. At some point of time, it's going to erupt. But that you have to leave to history. Am I contradicting myself? I think I'm contradicting myself too well here. You know, I say yes and I say no. But there's no other way.
And you've spoken about how you identify as a Kashmiri in exile, as a documentary filmmaker who is in exile from maybe a more mainstream Indian approach to filmmaking. Who do you identify with when it comes to your practice as a filmmaker, as a storyteller of sorts? Is there a documentary filmmaking tradition in India that you very much see yourself as part of the conversation within, or do you identify more with kind of practices here in the United States or elsewhere? Is it a kind of a mixed constellation of influence and of colleagues that you have?
It's quite mixed, because I think my filmmaking training and my filmmaking, the learning, is you take from all over the world. It doesn't belong to any specific country. I think the most primary influence on my filmmaking is European kind of filmmaking, French and German documentaries and fiction making. I like Fassbinder quite a lot. I like many European filmmakers more than Hollywood and Bollywood. So somewhere that influence will translate or seep through your work. My tendency is to think that what I'm doing is I'm creating my own original stuff. You know, I just want to keep that feeling. But it will be, you know, it's taking from some source somewhere.
But it's interesting that you mentioned Fassbinder, because yeah. Fassbinder is not necessarily a documentary
filmmaker. He's not
a filmmaker.
But I think fiction is truer than documentary. I got into documentary filmmaking by default, because I wanted to make films about Kashmir. And I couldn't do fiction films, though I've written many about Kashmir. So maybe that was my point of entry. And I don't generally make films about anything or anybody, you know, in India. Fiction is my source of influence, even for my documentary. I try to make documentaries in a way which resemble fiction, you know. fiction mode of storytelling, fictional narrative. So, I mean, it's not documentary. I'm not into reality. I'm creating a reality with images which exist, you know, that kind of thing.